on every case and flame, nigga.
Come on.
If it's from the cherry.
90 a.m. in Montreal.
The controversial weapons manufacturer General Dynamics has a plant in Valleyfield near Montreal, which has been approved for expansion. The U.S.-based armaments maker plans to add 12 to 15 new buildings to the Valleyfield site by 2028. This expansion could see up to 150 job openings at General Dynamics in the area. This comes at a time when Canada's government is making generational investments in the Canadian Armed Forces, recently reaching NATO's 2% defense spending target. Last week, Prime Minister Mark Carney announced a partnership with General Dynamics, including a $2 billion investment for the weapons manufacturer to build a new fleet of armored vehicles for the armed forces.
In this more dangerous and divided world, Canadian leadership will be defined not but just by the strength of our values, but also the value of our strength. That strength must be modernized, reinforced, and built to last.
Increasing military spending is a central aspect of Prime Minister Carney's Liberal government. The current Valleyfield General Dynamics expansion, for example, is receiving $355.7 million for these new facilities. This plant in Valleyfield produces nitrocellulose propellant, a type of propellant used in weaponry sold to both the United States and the Nation of Israel. According to the latest arms embargo report, this plant in Valleyfield is the sole supplier of this propellant, which is used in the ongoing United Nations declared genocide in the Gaza Strip. Local activist group Stop General Dynamics is opposed to the expansion on both peace activist and environmental grounds. Here is local activist Reyna from Stop General Dynamics.
It's in alignment with the strategic defense direction that Canada is taking, which is to increase spending on weapons and the defense sector, taking a much more aggressive turn towards militarization. So we are at the core against that. We are against any form of increased militarization, and more so General Dynamics. This expansion is to meet increased demands for the propellant, the explosive material that GD manufactures and ends up being used by the IOF, as you mentioned, in Palestine, Lebanon, Iran, and other places.
Organizing is still ongoing around the General Dynamics expansion, but the group is trying to get locals in Valleyfield on board and in opposition to the facilities being built. But with this $355.7 million investment for the facilities and an additional $2 billion for General Dynamics announced last week, preventing this expansion is an uphill battle.
If we're to defend and promote our values of freedom, democracy, peace, we must do so from a position of strength. If we want a stronger world, if we want a safer world, we need a stronger Canada.
For CJLO News and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Adam Innes.
Hi, you're listening to Dreamscapes on CJLO 1690 AM. I am here with Eric Lewis from the band Ton Rev, and also a very, can I call you a dream nerd? Is that accurate? And I mean it in a positive sense.
I've been called many kinds of nerds, so I think dream nerd, I'll plead guilty.
Okay, good. I am also a dream nerd, obviously, because I do a show about dreams. So, yeah, you have like some very interesting dream stories to share with us. Yeah. Do you want to start off with your band so that we make sure we touch on that? Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we're all equals in this band, but in a sense, I founded and, as I'll describe, actually dreamed this band called Ton Rev, Tone Dreams. It could also be Our Dreams. It could be the dreams of the tones themselves or dreaming of tones. Mm. And literally about 10 years ago, I had a dream, like many of us have, a dream that had a kind of visceral reality to it. And we tend to separate the dream world from reality. And I think that is a mistake in and of itself.
Yeah.
And in this dream, I was improvising with six individuals who are actually also exist outside of the dream world. It was Eric Craven, a drummer, Peter Burton, an upright bass player, Genevieve Gauthier, who plays reeds, primarily saxophone, Emily Fortin, who plays trumpet and brass, and Julie Richard, who plays tuba, and myself playing cornet and bass clarinet. And in the dream, I don't know how to put it other than we sounded really good.
Yeah.
And this is a rather eclectic group of musicians, and we had never played together. I had played with all of them in like Marty Spaghetti configurations, one-off little improvisations. And I woke up and it just stayed with me like, this is a really good band and it sounds good in the dream world, and maybe it could also kind of break out into what we call the non-dream world. And so I called each of them, or maybe I emailed them, and I said, you are in my dream band, which has that nice double meaning in this case. Would you like to try playing? And I was really surprised. Everyone said yes. So we all met at the studio I share with some other musicians, including Peter Burton. And we did sound great, you know. But what was really interesting is we sounded sympathetic with each other, even though we come from very different kinds of musical homes, if you know what I mean, different musical backgrounds. Since then, Emily and Julie, just due to their own recording and touring schedules, after 2 or 3 years, they had to sort of bow out. But we've been a steady quartet now for a good 8 or 9 years. And it is literally a dream band. In fact, we have next Monday, we're launching our cassette, Toaster Broken, at Petit Ours with two other ensembles of folks who must be very serious dreamers. I actually think musicians of a certain sort who have a certain openness and willingness to possibility in music, that's kind of what dreams present us with. They allow us to enrich the horizons of the possible. Things we thought were impossible, sonically impossible, become possible. And so I'm sure they're all serious dreamers. It'll be the duo of Belinda Campbell, who's a wonderful musician. Anything she touches, I don't even know whether she'll be playing keyboards, electronics, or something else. And Raphael Foisy-Couture, equally someone who can make sounds from whatever he chooses. And then a trio of Cabral Jacob, who also is a multi-instrumentalist, on reeds, on bass, on guitar. Chloe Hickson-Reynolds, who plays the whole reed family, and I suspect more. And Evelyn Charlotte-Joe, who's also a very skillful.
We know Evelyn.
So I think it's going to be really...
Sorry, you can finish the sentence about her, though, but she's very skilled. Yeah.
Yes, a wonderful, primarily drums, percussion. Mm-hmm. So it'll be these three ensembles, and maybe if the mood hits us, we'll all join forces at the end. But that'll be next Monday, and... you know, when you improvise with people, you're kind of actualizing a dream world, right? You're having to, in real time, you don't know what's going to happen. You lack a certain kind of agency, but at the same time, you're manifesting your agency very strongly. You're inhabiting the improvisation while also listening to it as if you're an outside agent. And those are really characteristics also of our relationships to dream. So I really do think a lot of really skillful improvisers are folks who realize the dream world boundary of what we call reality is a permeable one, right? Mm. And that they can step in it and outside of it. And some of the other most really important and meaningful musical collaborations I've had are with folks who very consciously evoked the dream world. People like Pauline Oliveros and Ione, who travel freely between those different modes of reality, and it inflects their creative work very seriously.
Yeah. Do you want to tell us a bit more about that?
Sure. Many of you may know of Pauline Oliveros. If you don't know her by name, you may know of deep listening, which was a practice she developed and taught and is still actively taught by folks here in Montreal and internationally. I had the pleasure of both working with her on a number of projects, Sonic and otherwise, and playing in an ensemble with her. And, well, I'll tell one story. She passed actually 10 years ago this November. She transitioned into the vibrational world, which I think is one corner of the dream world. And the day after she passed, I received a phone call from her partner, Ione, who actually runs dream workshops, who holds meetings in the dream world, telling me that Pauline had transitioned. And I work at McGill University, and I was walking home over the mountain that afternoon, and you know, I was sad and contemplative and thinking about Pauline and thinking about, well, what I was going to miss from my engagements with her. And I was in the bit of Montreal Park near, like, the statue and the gazebo, you know, and walking along the grass. And suddenly, all my sense perceptions, in particular audition, changed radically. And I literally stopped. I like stopped moving, and I heard the leaves. You know, it was late fall. There were dry leaves on the trees rustling, but I was able to hear each one individually. You know, I didn't hear them as a mass. And I heard water running. And I go there all the time. There is no water running, and I realized it was running underground. I was like hearing underground streams. And I heard two dogs barking. And it sounded like they were yipping at my feet. And I looked up and they were like 200, 300 meters away. So I had this intense heightened hearing. And it must have lasted, I mean, it felt like a lifetime. I don't know, maybe it was 90 seconds. And then it faded away and my normal audition came back, and it was clear that was a visitation from Pauline and that this was her last lesson to me, right? Wow. And she had given lessons to so many. I was in no way privileged in this, but she was like saying, this is the state you're after, right? Mm-hmm. This is my last, like, now you got to get there on your own, you know. And it was to this day, a very moving experience. And it was definitely a visit from a different aspect of our reality, and one which I think dream states are somehow first cousins of this or versions of them, and that, you know, what we come to learn in dream states and what I came to learn in that moment point towards the need to interrogate these kinds of states we might be in and not only define them as we often do negatively, like there's the state we're in now and there's the world we're in now, and then we define things like dream states as not that, and somehow somehow in that sense less real or less important and maybe less able to have us learn important things about ourselves and the world, because they're not of the world in some sense. But I think that's not really a true and not a profitable way of thinking about them. And that, you know, folks like Pauline Oliveros and folks like Sun Ra and folks like Alice Coltrane are people who really just dissolved the kind of boundary between dream worlds and what we might call, you know, what too many of us call the world, right? And inhabited both at the same time, moved freely between them, and had richer experiences for that, you know? So, yeah, so that was a kind of a profound moment, and it's one which I try to... I'm sure I'll spend the rest of my life and fail to try to again access, you know, whether it's while playing music or listening to music or walking in the woods. And one thing about Pauline's own pedagogic practice is that, and what I think was unique about her is, I think she was always in that state. Like that is the state she inhabited, you know.
Wow. Thank you so much. That's like, it's so, such a powerful, yeah, you can move it. It's okay. Yeah. Such a powerful story. And, I guess I have a couple questions just in terms of, the kind of work that you did with Pauline Oliveros. And then also, I know you were talking about, the epistemological experience of music and, and the inner and the outer and how that links with the dream world. And you started to talk about it, but I'd love if you went back into that too. Yeah.
Well, again, I mean, let's start with Pauline. I think as a dreamer, I think she saw possibilities where other people would see impossibilities, right? I mean, one feature of our dream life is, you know, things happen in our dreams, happen to us, or we witness them, we experience them. And when you try to describe them to someone, you're like, well, you know, I was walking up the stairs, but I wasn't really going up them, and they were going up, but they weren't going up, and I met my aunt, but it wasn't my aunt, but it was my aunt, and then we were swimming in the ocean, but the ocean wasn't the, you know, and you find yourself trying to describe what, when you put it discursively and semantically, it seems like you're describing impossible states of being, impossible situations, right? Impossible ways the world could be. I think Pauline and others, you know, of the folks I've had the pleasure to encounter with any regularity, she was a spectacularly skillful at this. But the what they take from the dream world is maybe possibility is richer and more open than we think it is. Maybe what we take to be possible is configured by our experiences in ways that delimits it. This actually fits in an interesting way with various bits of critical race theory, right? Which sees one crucial way in which colonialism and racism and patriarchy operate is to atrophy the sense of possibility for oppressed people. And you need to find a way to have them have a richer sense of possibilities for themselves, for their communities, for their culture, for everyone, for the world, right? And I think Pauline did this in so many distinct spheres. So one project I worked with her, among many others, not many other projects, many of us worked on this project, was to design musical instruments for folks with severe physical disabilities. But that started with her recognition that it is not impossible for this person locked into their body with no motor control to make music. It's only impossible if you say it is, if you don't sort of think in a dreamlike way. And so she would set these challenges, and she also was a fantastic technical designer and developer herself, right? She's one of the founders of electronic music, and so she wasn't just thinking these ideas and telling others to implement them, but this project resulted in the design of very simple digitally based instruments to allow someone who all they can do is move their eyes to make music. And I think you got a whole host of technical issues, right? But you never even get to them if you don't start with someone who says, don't tell me, right? This is impossible. And I think the folks who say, don't tell me this is impossible, are often folks who inhabit a dream world, which our dreams tell us nothing is impossible, right? In a sense. So I think a lot of her projects came from that sort of that place, whether it's it and her musical practice itself and her deep listening practice is one which asks you to challenge what you think are the limitations of audition. Think about how in dreams you often say things like, and I was hearing this sound, but it's not really a sound, right? And I was hearing how the rose smelled, and I was, you know, and you might say to yourself upon awakening, well, no, that just can't happen, right? And then Pauline tells you to walk softly as if you have ears on the bottom of your feet, right? And tells you to listen to things that you might think don't actually make sound, right? And with practice, you really can enrich your sonosphere and realize it can possibly contain more than you thought it was. Even if it's something as simple as this, we tend to think we have control over our vision in a way we don't over our hearing, right? We choose what to look at, but we don't choose what to hear, right? Sounds just impinge upon us. In that sense, I thought to be almost offensive, right? They kind of, we can't control them. But Pauline's like, well, who said that? Right? Who says you can't control what you listen to? And she developed practices and exercises that would help you learn that you can control your listening the way we control vision. And again, you know, there's long stories to tell about how, you know, oculocentrism is a product of modernity and is part of the development of colonialism and patriarchal strategy. I mean, these are stories worth telling, you know, at some point. Yeah. But at one level, she was just like, no, like, I'm just talking about listening. And once she realized you can listen to things you don't think you can listen to, like we do in dreams, right? She was able, I think, to take the practice out of the dream world. Yeah. And you could take a practice out of the dream world into this world only once you realize they're not really different worlds, right? They're both equally real worlds, and that we can move between them with practice.
Right.
And we can come to understand things about ourselves, about others, about our environment in both states. And one thing I'm interested in is thinking about the state we often or sometimes find ourselves in when we listen intently to music, and thinking about that hopefully profitably with respect to dream states and what dream researchers and the phenomenology of dreaming seems to tell us about those states. Because, you know, so many of us who listen to music and have it play an important role in our lives do so because we're striving for an experience. Maybe it's an experience we only have rarely. Maybe for some of us it's an experience you have often. But it's different, right? It's different than listening to your radio in the car, right? It's different than hearing some music off the street. It's even different from putting on the music in your home. You don't necessarily get in that state, right? But this is a state that's important to so many people, right? And I've been trying to think about ways in which that state might bear similarities to our relationship to our dreams, and what that might tell us about both states. And I mean, I can say a little more about that. Yeah,
definitely.
Sure. Yeah. So one thing that seems to be true about our relationship to our dreams is that we both seem to be external to our dreams and internal to them at the same time, right? What does one mean by that? So the sense in which people often describe their dreams as they're external to them is that you seem to be witnessing them, right? You don't seem to have control over them. You don't have control over the narrative, if there is a narrative, right? Almost like you're watching or hearing them, right? In that sense, the dreams seem to be happening to you, right? You're outside it. Oh my God, you know, if you have a scary dream, you can't end it. And it seems to be external to you and happening to you. But at the same time, and that external feature seems to be pretty clearly a feature of many dreams most of the time, right? But also, we seem to inhabit our dreams, right? The emotional content of the dream, the affective features of the dream, seem also to be ours while we're having the dream, right? So in that sense, we're internal to the dream, right? We're experiencing it and also having it, right, at the same time, right? Yeah. So they seem to be both external and internal to us. And a lot of folks think this is really an interesting and maybe essential characteristic of dreams. And then there's this question you can have, which is there any other thing? Are there any other states we might be in that we seem to both, that both seem to happen to us, but also are internal to us in certain ways? And when I think of, and I have no reason to think this is universal, when I try to do a kind of self-phenomenology of my deep listening to music, it seems to have those same features, right? So you're listening to this music, which in some sense is external to you, right? Maybe you're not making it. You're not the performer. So you're witnessing it. You're not controlling how it's going to happen. But it becomes internal to you in certain ways. The kinds of expressiveness of the music, the meaningfulness of it, right? We say all the time, you feel the music, right? So it's both external to you and somehow internal to you. And in that sense, it seems to be share this feature with dream states. And at the same time, for many of us, I think when we're in this state of intense musical listening, it's clear to other people watching us, right? That you're in a different state, right? You tap on your shoulder and you don't respond right away. Maybe your eyes are closed. Maybe your bodily comportment has changed. Your breathing has changed, right? All these things also change, right, as we descend into various stages of sleep, including those stages of sleep where we dream. But it's clear you're not asleep, right? The deep state of listening is not that, oh, I just fell asleep and I'm daydreaming, right? Which is an interesting state in and of itself, right? What do we really mean by that? It's often used to disparage the state in certain ways, but maybe it too is one which gives us access to certain kinds of understandings that require that state, right? So I've been thinking about the state of deep engagement with music along with the kind of states that we seem to be in when dreaming, not to collapse the two into one, but to say maybe these are both states which, due to the fact that we experience them both externally and internally, might make them useful, if I wanted to put it in really lay terms, you know, epistemically important, if I wanted to put on like my philosopher hat.
Right.
Because I think both of these states have this rich potential for being a site of knowledge production. Mm. What might one mean by that, right? So in general terms, when we want to come to understand something, know about something, there tend to be two ways we need to engage with the object of knowledge, right? So if you want to learn about, you know, the microphones here in the studio, what are you going to do? You're going to, like, test them. You're going to observe them. You're going to experiment with them, right? You're going to have an external relationship to them, right? Things are going to happen to it. You're going to observe the behavior of the microphone. And by observing the behavior of the microphone, it's out there, right? You're external to it. You learn something about it. There's a whole bunch of other things which we don't learn a lot about them by observing them, right? You don't learn much about love by observing love. You learn about love by being in love, right? You don't learn about happiness, right, by observing it. You learn about happiness by being happy. This is where the arts come in, right? You can learn from a certain external perspective about love or happiness from poets, mm-hmm. right, from authors. But that's a kind of secondary learning, right? Our primary way we understand love, what it is, happiness, what it is, anger, what it is, fear, what it is, oppression, what it is, right, is by experiencing it, right, internally, right? So there's a sense in which the things we want to learn about, you know, in our realities, some of them we need to have an external relationship to. Some of them we need to have an internal relationship to. In dreams, we seem to have both to the content and objects of our dreams. Maybe in listening to music, our relationship to the music is both. And that means there's the potential to learn about these things from both of those perspectives, whatever their content is, right? So in that sense, they're potentially epistemically really rich sites for knowledge production. And of course, those of us who pay attention to our dreams think we learn things. We learn, and not just self-knowledge. We learn, there's a source, it's a site of self-knowledge. It's a site of knowledge about all sorts of things. We solve problems.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
We come to realize that, fill in the blank, right? You know, my aunt's not really being nice to me when she, right? Or I'm not sure that's, it could be something as narrow as that, or it could be something really big, like, you know, I don't think I should go to grad school. Mm-hmm. you learn things about, you know, how you want your life to unfold. Mm-hmm. Similarly, in these deep states of listening to music, we come to learn things not just about the music. We do learn deep things about the music that we couldn't otherwise access. But I think it's also, for me, a site where when I'm in this state, I'm thinking the music seems to have dropped out, right? And all sorts of thoughts and things. I come to realize something about the day, about relationships to people, about all sorts of stuff, which isn't in any obvious way about the music itself, but it's the music is playing some sort of causal role. The same way when you learn things about yourself in a dream, it's not necessarily because the content of your dream was about what you learned, right?
Right, yeah.
Like, you may come to learn, you know, my aunt's not as nice a person as I thought. Not because in your dream your aunt is a character and she's not being nice, right? You can't really say what is the connection to coming to learn that, but it's clear the dream is the causal agent, right? Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is also true, at least for me and maybe others, for what you come to learn and understand when listening to music. Sorry, that's been a kind of long,
road, but you know, because I was like, okay, let's let him cook, because he really, I really wanted to make sure we got through some of the stuff that you had brought up, and this is great. It's made me think about a lot of things. Mm. I think it's really interesting thinking about how it's true that, like, for instance, happiness, you might think that you are learning about what happiness is by seeing what makes other people happy, but the real crux of that is actually being like, you don't learn what makes you happy by observing what makes other people happy. Yeah, so I like that as like a one of the starting off points of what you're saying, that that there has to be some kind of internal internalized landscape of what it makes sense specifically to you as a person. And it makes me think too of, like, just with my background in visual arts, like, there's this thing called the intention witness process, which is like an art therapist, Pat Allen, who went to art school, and she was having a really hard time. She would, like, sometimes make these paintings that she was really proud of, but then she couldn't replicate it. She couldn't get back into the state that she wanted to be in when she was making, like, a really beautiful portrait that really captured some kind of essential quality of a person. And so she came up with this kind of, I think it relates to deep listening, but it's visual. She came up with this exercise she would do with herself where she would write something down. She would write down, like, a question, and then she would, like, throw it away, like, just put it away from herself. And then she would make art for as much time as she felt like she needed. Sometimes it was like a few hours. And then at the end, she would, like, kind of dialogue with it and kind of spend time seeing what the art wanted to say to her, what she wanted to say to the art, and then often from that experience of, like, talking to the art and experiencing the art in that way, the thing that she had written about many hours earlier that she completely forgotten about, often because of that kind of dreamlike connection, you know, in the way that art kind of, like, takes you on this ride through your subconscious that isn't totally linear, there was a connection and there was an answer, even though she, you know, had completely forgotten what that question was. So I don't know. I feel like there's a relationship there too with that.
Yeah. I mean, look, I mean, it's standard in psychology of dreaming, right, and the notions of the subconscious that, you know, reality can often get in the way, right, of having us access the reasons behind why we're feeling what we're feeling, or thinking what we're thinking, or behaving in the way that we're behaving, right? And that a dream state, insofar as it is not grounded in what we call, right, just reality, can foreground those connections, right? That, you know, when we're in a waking state, we tend to think of our perceptions from our five senses and the kind of our stream of consciousness that we have access to is like the signal, and our idle thoughts, right? Our daydreams are like the noise. But then in the dream state, you can flip that, right? And you may discover some of that noise that was impinging upon your day was trying to tell you something important, right? Yeah. And that your dreams don't parse everything into signal and noise in the same way, you know? A philosopher who was evil in many ways, right, but talks about the free play of ideas and imagination, right, as being constitutive of an aesthetic experience, right?
Who's that?
Immanuel Kant.
Okay.
Right. He also has terrible things to say about black folks and women. Yeah. But theorized about aesthetic experience in ways that many find he's on to something, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and this kind of free play is something that, again, is characteristic of dream states, right? That and it has to do with, I think, among other things, losing the barriers we place on possibility, right? When awake, when going to our jobs, right? So all the norms that govern our behaviors on the street, right? Drive to the right. I'm not suggesting you shouldn't, right? Many of these norms are really important, right? But like all these norms, you know, collectively are basically doing, among other things, when they tell you what to do and what not to do, they're also telling you what is possible and what is not possible, right? And that some of us are bounded by more of them than others, right? I'm a barely still middle-aged white man who's a professor. I'm bound by many fewer of these norms, right? My fields of possibility are wider, right, than they are for many others who face systematic oppressions, right, who are told you cannot imagine for yourself this or this or this or this or this, right? Dreams are places where ideally your free play of imagination could open that up for you. Look, this is an important part of Afrofuturism, right? You know, when Sun Ra intones, right, you can be whoever you want to be, you know, anything is possible for you. Space, in that sense, why is space a place? Because it's a place where the possibilities are much wider, right? Afrofuturism as a literary form, as manifestations in many arts, is, among other things, a way of saying these are possible futures. You have to come to realize that they can be possible futures, right? That, in many ways, right, that boundary between the possible and the impossible is dissolved away in our dreams to a great degree. And that's why I think science fiction and dreaming are so closely related to each other.
Yeah. This is always so interesting to hear your perspective on this. Do you want to add something before we do the ad break?
Let's do
the ad break. I feel like we've touched on most. I do want to hear about your serial dreams from when you were
sure.
a kid.
Yeah.
And
we'll come down from these heavy heights
to more silly stuff. You are and have been listening to Dreamscapes on CJLO with Eric Lewis, who knows a lot about dreams. Whoop. And we're going to go to some ads real quick. We'll be back soon.
Reporting a breezy, light 22 degrees here in Montreal. Perfect weather for a bikini. Oh, hold on. Wait, there's a new forecast coming in. It's reaching up to 46 degrees. Well, you're definitely going to have to wear your bikini. Wait, sorry. Hold on. Oh my God. I'm getting reports. We're having a zombie attack. Well, Jeff, the weather is still perfect for a bikini. Make sure to find shelter and arm yourself. Tune in to Bikini Broadcast every Tuesday at 6 p.m.
Free, free, free family fun event at Raymond Prefontaine Park next to the Prefontaine Metro. Live broadcast from CJLO 1690 AM. We have Ja Army Sound, Sly Roots, DJ Neo B, Bobo Naki, Levi Conscious, Captain C, Real VI, K Dot, Sabu, sponsored by the Government of Canada, Factor, Lion Strong International Records, Sick Music Production, Invert Life, Food by Miss Barbecue Queen, and many more. Red Hot Revolution Fest, August 22, 2026. Make it a date. Don't be late.
Music. Dive into the ultimate comic haven at Crossover Comics. Unleash your inner geek with the best selection of graphic novels, manga, games like Pokemon and Magic, in-store events, merch, and more. Our knowledgeable and friendly staff have got your back with awesome recommendations for your next read. Score big with a free account. Enjoy comic subscriptions and membership discounts. Be in on the action at 3560 Notre Dame West in St. Henry, right near Metro Lionel Brew. Crossover Comics, sharing your passions since 2012.
Tune in to CJLO 1690 AM.
All adventurous women do.
Hi, you are listening to Dreamscapes on CJLO 1690 AM.
We were dreaming.
Yeah, sorry, and I didn't get your mic on. Okay, we're back. We're back with a little bit more dream talk. I think you had some ideas about what to share, and Eric also kind of has made this dream playlist, which I think I'll post, and so people will know what we would have played if we had had the time to play stuff. But you're always welcome to come back on and talk more dream stuff and play music. Do you want to start with your serial dreams as a child first, or do you want to?
Okay. I mean, I don't know how interesting this is, but I'd be curious to know if others had dreams like this. I can remember some of my dreams from when I was very little, like kindergarten, you know.
Amazing.
And this was, you know, the 60s. And it was an age, you know, watching a lot of, you know, cartoons, and it was the Jetsons and the Flintstones. And I used to have these series of dreams in which I was inhabiting a kind of like space hero. You know, I was flying around this little spaceship, very Jetsons-like.
Nice.
Doing good deeds to save the galaxy against the evil aliens. And even now I realize I was internal and external to them, because in the dream I'm watching, right, the spaceship that I'm in. And it's not, of course, me in the spaceship, but it was me.
Right? Of course.
And the curious feature these dreams had is they had a kind of serialized narrative, like a kid's cartoon television show. So in one of them, you know, I'd be chased by three, you know, space aliens, and they're about to catch my spaceship, and the dream would end, but the dream would actually have a voiceover, and it would be like, you know, tune in tomorrow night to see if our hero can escape from the clutches of the, you know, whatever they were called in my dream. And my dream the next night, or a dream the next night, really would pick up from there.
That's amazing.
And so I had like a, you know, sketched out kids television show, but of course it wasn't a kids television show. It was my inner life, right? Yeah. You know, that somehow would have these sort of continuities night for night. I can't now say, you know, how many episodes were there, but it wasn't two, you know, it was significant enough for me to have like remembered it. And occasionally I recall looking forward to going to bed, wondering what was going to happen to me, you know, and it was never scary. I was never worried. So in some sense, I had agency, even though I didn't have agency. That's that same internal, external kind of thing. But this was curious. And I do wonder if others had similar kinds of episodic dreams. I just don't know.
Yeah, I mean, episodic is pretty, like, it's in the same family as recurring, but yours are building on each other. So that's actually pretty, like, that's a little different, right? Yeah. That's like more...
You know, this wasn't the same dream again, even a variant of it. It definitely was like a continuation of it.
Yeah, that's pretty special, I think. Yeah.
It's even before I started doing drugs. So who knows what this was about?
Yeah. Right, yeah. Well, you can tell us about the dreams you had when you were on drugs next time if you want. Did you also want to talk about art in the margins?
Well, yeah, I mean, this discussion's making me think about how rich this notion of dreaming impossibility is. So, Peter Burton, a fine musician, art activist, the artistic curator and director of the Flux Festival, and I founded what is now a charity called Arts in the Margins. And one of our mandates, one thing we realized, is how many artists, and to be frank, many of them racialized artists, queer artists, or are artists who have been told by society, by communities, by granting agencies, by promoters, maybe by their families, who knows, that this is what is possible for you. These other things are impossible for you. And we see one function of Arts in the Margins is to help such artists dream of futures for themselves more widely than they have. So if you're an artist who thought, and it could be, this is where the mundane and the rich kind of cohabitate, right? So it could be someone who thinks, oh, I can never apply for that Canada Council grant. People like me don't get those. That's not a grant for me. Right? Our role is to say, well, maybe it isn't tomorrow, but maybe it is down the road, and maybe we need that to enter into your field of possibility. We need you to dream what that would be like, and our job is to help you get there eventually. Right? So it's a organization which, among other things, recognizes to what degree systems of power in the arts, oppressive systems of power, racist systems of power, misogynist systems of power, operate. And we think it's important, one of the crucial ways in which they oppress is to prevent artists from dreaming possible futures for themselves. Mm-hmm. And so we want to make a small intervention in this and assist artists in dreaming more richly for themselves. And it's not really completely unrelated to this, because once you can imagine the mundane as something for you, oh, maybe I can apply for that $100,000 grant. you now think creatively in different ways, right? Mm-hmm. And you broaden your creative horizons. And we believe that the dominant power structures in the art very consciously operate as tools, right, of white supremacy, as tools of patriarchy, as colonial tools, as literally products of them, as part of those structures, work to atrophy the dreams of primarily non-white men, right? You know, people who are not white.
And men.
Men, right? Yeah. Sorry, that everybody, came out a bit
yeah.
wrong. You know, right?
Yeah, yeah. So, everybody who is a non-white
yes,
man
that's right, right.
is going to have
so,
a hard time.
I think that's one way in which dreaming and the arts and possibility could even manifest themselves as what you might think is something so foreign from that is like the mandate of a charity, you know?
Right.
And I think for me, and Peter had been doing this work for a long time. For me, it was Pauline, I think, who really made me think in those terms. And I think for her, it was really coming directly out of these heightened phenomenological states, these dream states, you know.
Wow. Eric, probably you'll have to come back to keep talking because we're coming to the end of the show, if you feel like it. If you
one can dream
yeah no but it's been really amazing to hear all these stories, and I know that you're writing a book about Jean Lee.
Yeah.
I might play You Stepped Out of a Dream.
It's a lovely piece, and I think one thing she's doing is evoking this feeling literally of dreaming of someone and what that feels like.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I have to hear about your engagement with dreams at
some
point.
Yeah, I'm going to tell you. We'll talk after. Right. You've been listening to Dreamscapes on CGLO, and this is Jean Lee and Rand Blake with You Stepped Out of a Dream. Stay tuned for Pressure Drop.
You're listening to CJLO 1690